Most of us work better under some kind of deadline. For three writers in Cedar Rapids, a diagnosis of terminal cancer created an all-too-real deadline, one that resulted in three published novels. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. When Lennox Randon asked his friends Rob Klein and Dennis Green to form a writing group with him, they were reluctant until he mentioned his diagnosis with incurable gastrointestinal cancer. The men have been meeting, writing, reading, and helping each other polish their work for more than 2 years, and it has paid off with three separate publishing contracts. I'll talk with Lennox Randon, Rob Klein, and Dennis Green this hour. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. There are a lot of writing groups out there, but it's very rare for a writing group to have a 100% completion rate of a project. It's very rare, even rarer still, for a writing group to have a 100% publication rate. But Lennox Randon, Rob Klein, and Dennis Green have been writing together for a little over 2 years. Randon and Rob both have novels that have just been released, and Dennis's book is coming out this fall. That in and of itself is remarkable, but it's only part of the story. And all three men are here with me today. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Morning. Morning.
And Randon, the story really starts with you. This writing group was your idea, and I understand that the idea for a writing group came out of a diagnosis that you had with terminal cancer.
It started out, actually, I had cancer, I had surgery, did chemo, and I thought I was cured. So I thought, there's things I want to get done, and if cancer ever comes back, you know, 10, 15, 20 years down the line, I want to be able to say I've done something significant. And so I approached Rob about forming a writing group. And 2 months into the process, then my cancer came back and metastasized, and things got really scary after that.
But you stuck with the idea, even though you were going through that. Why was it so important to you to get involved in this group and to work on your novel?
To be honest, writing is a wonderful distraction. It keeps me from thinking about if I'm going to get sick that night on the chemo or what my next CAT scan result's going to be. It puts me in another world. And in that other world, I don't have cancer. I'm a character in my novel.
And was this a novel that you had worked on your own before?
I tried another novel, which was a historical fiction novel, and there was so much research involved, I decided I would try a simpler novel for my first novel. And so the resulting one is this simpler novel. And I tried working on it for about a year or a year and a half, and I just was not making any progress. So I knew I needed someone to be responsible to.
All right. And that first someone was Rob Klein, who is also the marketing manager at Hanscher Auditorium at the University of Iowa. So you've heard him on this show before. Rob, how did you and Randon get together?
Well, Randon was coaching a Lego League team with my wife, Jenny, and they got to talking about the fact that 15 years prior to that, I had written a few chapters of a mystery novel. And one of the things I discovered about a mystery novel is that it ought to have a plot and that I didn't know what the plot was. And so I'd set it aside and I'd come back to it and nibbled at it a little bit. But I had no idea who'd done what or why or any of those sorts of things. And so when Randon called me up and said we should form this group, I said, no. that's very sweet, Randon, but I'm never going to finish this book. I don't know what happened. I just don't know anything about what happens next. And Randon played the cancer card. And I said, all right, fine. We will get together every week and we'll see if we can figure this out, right? And so we started doing that. And not too far in, I was leaving one night. I'd scribbled out a few things that week. And as I was walking out Randon's door, he said, next week, Rob, we each need to have 4 pages. 4 pages? I'm like, sure, I can have 4 pages. But, you know, it turns out that if you sit down and you do the work, you can write 4 pages a week and or 10 pages a week or whatever it might turn out to be. And again, as Randon says, that responsibility to one another, to the three of us, to inviting Dennis into the team as well, is what makes it work.
All right. And Dennis, how did you get involved?
Well, it's exactly the same story. Rob mentions to me that he and his new friend Randon have been getting together and working on their projects. And he said, you know, you really ought to join us. And I said, you know, I don't really, I wasn't even as far as Rob. I got a couple ideas. I don't have anything developed. I don't have the time. My friend Randon has cancer. Okay. and so I wrote up a chapter and sent it off to both of them and said, you know, if you guys like this and want to hear more, I'm in. And that was how it started.
Mm-hmm. And Dennis, you are the general manager at KCCK Radio in Cedar Rapids, affiliated with Kirkwood Community College. So, Randon, your history is as a former cop, as a technical writer. So really, among the three of you, you're the one who really had the most experience writing, it seems.
In a way, but Rob, you're an English major, right?
Well, I am a recovering English major. That's certainly true.
And Rob is also the only one whose writing actually makes money, because in his off times, he's a grant writer.
That's right.
So his writing actually makes tens of thousands of dollars. He just doesn't get a key.
I just
right.
don't get any
well,
of it.
And it's highly compelling to
right,
read.
Yes.
I'm sure you could probably
gripping.
Right sell a whole lot of that. So, all right. What was the process like? Once the three of you got together, you met about once a week?
Most Sunday evenings around 6:30 in the evening. We'd get together in my basement, and we'd all bring our pages in, and we'd exchange pages. And then there's this quiet period of about 15 or 20 minutes while we're reading each other's work and writing it up. And then we discuss.
And that has worked. That process has worked really, really well. You know, the idea that we don't burden each other by sending – well, sometimes I do. But we try not to send pages out in advance and ask them to each other to read them over the week. We actually get together and read the work together silently and then discuss it. And that discussion is everything from typos to your character wouldn't talk like that to I don't think that piece of the plot is quite what you mean. But it's mostly, yep, you should keep going. And that really, the real pleasure and gift of a writing group is that, yep, you shouldn't quit. You shouldn't stop. You should keep going is again, what makes this process work.
It's that accountability of not being the guy who wants to show up to group with no pages that gets the work done. And it's the encouragement on the way out that makes it possible to do the work the next week. Writing, you know, is a very, very solitary thing. And if you don't have that inner fire or a reason to keep writing every day, you're just not going to do it. Life is going to get in the way. But this is a way that made sure that we all had the priority to do it.
Now, you were joking about Randon playing the cancer card and getting this group together. And, of course, I'm sure everyone in this room wishes that cancer was not a part of this story. But it strikes me that it was a motivating factor for you, Randon, because you really wanted to get this novel done. It was on your bucket list in some ways.
Right.
But it also must have really been a motivator for the two of you. In what way did you find motivation in Randon's cancer?
Well, that's absolutely right. I've said several times, you know, that when I write, I tend to write in the morning just before work, and that when I'm stuck and I can't come up with anything else and I want to put the book away, remember, I'd already put this book away and decided I wasn't ever going to finish it, then I can say, well, if I put this away, I'm not just letting myself down. I'm not just letting Dennis down. I'm letting Randon down, and not to put too fine a point on it, but Randon might die, you know, and I don't want to be the guy, and I know Dennis doesn't want to be the guy either, who gave up on this project just because we couldn't think what came next in our book. That would be silly.
If Randon can find the time to write every day and meet with us with all of the things that are on his mind, we can certainly find the time to do it too. So it's a huge motivator for all of us.
So this was something you wanted to do, Randon. It was a distraction, has been a distraction for you through a difficult time. But what made it so important? Clearly, it's something that you really poured a lot of energy into.
Well, there are a variety of reasons. One is I wanted to leave something for my daughter to look back and say, my dad did this. And when she reads the bad jokes in the novel, she'll say, yep, that's my dad's sense of humor and so forth. So I wanted to leave something for her. And I think there was a part of me that just felt like I hadn't done anything major. I hadn't left a real legacy. And I wanted to leave kind of a legacy. And my mother had always said, you know, you should write a book, Lenny. You should write a book. And I finally did. Even though my mother's dead now, I feel kind of good about doing that for her, which I know doesn't really make a lot of sense, but it just kind of all comes together in that way.
Sure. How old is your daughter?
She's 15 now.
Has she read the book?
I'm not sure. She's kind of secretive about it. I know she's read part of it, and she's read part of the book I'm currently working on, and she likes my newer book better. But I'm not really sure. She's kind of secretive about whether she's really read the whole thing or not.
Oh, interesting.
My wife has read it, though.
Yeah. What was her reaction?
My wife loved it. She was very encouraging, and I was afraid it might bother her. You know, there's some violence in it and so forth. But she loves the book, and she says she sees me all through the book. When she reads it, she can hear my voice. So it's very wonderful that my wife likes my book, because I was thinking this might not be her cup of tea.
Well, and all three of the books are mysteries, and we'll just sort of start diving into what they're about. Although they're all mysteries, they're all really different books. And Randon, yours is called Friends, Dogs, Bullets, Lovers. Tell me just a little bit about the plot.
The basic plot is there are two guys that live in Iowa. They're in Dubuque. One's a police officer. One's an emergency medical technician with the fire department there. And because they work weird hours, they take their dogs out for walks late at night. And so they went to Maquoketa Cave State Park with their dogs, and they stumbled across some hitmen burying a body. And they capture the guy, but they're forced into witness protection. And so they're relocated to Texas, to Austin, Texas. And once they get there, they get kind of bored being civilians, and so they start doing some under-the-radar private investigations, which tend to give them even more trouble.
So the main character, well, they're both main characters, but it really focuses more on one than the other in many ways. He's a cop in Dubuque, Iowa. You have a history as a policeman. Is this an alter ego for you?
Yes. Be perfectly frank, yeah. Noah is pretty much me. Not completely, but pretty much me.
You at a certain point in your life?
Yeah, around age 30, which is quite a while back now.
So you know, when your wife reads it, she's seeing you too.
Right, uh-huh.
All right, we're going to take a short break here in a moment. When we get back, Randon, I'm going to have you read a little bit from your book, which again is called Friends, Dogs, Bullets, Lovers by Lennox Randon. We'll also hear a little bit about Murder by the Slice by Rob Klein and Traveler by Dennis Green. We're talking today about the experience of these three men with their writing group, the fact that they have a 100% completion rate, a 100% publication rate for the projects they've been working on over the past 2 years. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me this hour are three published authors, three members of a writing group. They've been writing together for a little over 2 years in Cedar Rapids. Lennox Randon is here, Rob Klein, and Dennis Green. They got together because Randon was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and that was a motivation for him to finish a novel that he'd been thinking about for a long time. It also turned out to be great motivation for Rob and Dennis to work on their novels. And now, again, all of these novels have come to completion, and there are three publishing contracts. Rob and Randon have their novels out. They've just been released, and Dennis's novel is coming out in October. The three of them will be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City on Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock. And Randon, before the break, we were focusing on your book, Friends, Dogs, Bullets, Lovers. And would you mind reading just a little bit from the book for us?
Not at all. I'll read a little bit of the prologue to set things up. Yesterday. Backup should get here any minute now, I think. Two dogs already lie dead in pools of blood 100 yards behind me. One human is dead, or dying, just a dozen yards in front of me. Or at least I hope he is, since I shot him. To be fair, he started it, sending a shotgun slug toward my best friend for no good reason. Admittedly, there are folks who could arguably make a logical case for killing us, but we'd never even met this particular ne'er-do-well. Now I don't know if my friends are dead or injured. I lost track of them, when the two other gunmen commenced shooting. My focus was on laying down cover fire, reloading my revolver, and avoiding the rounds headed in my general direction. Funny, a few months ago, I had never fired my duty revolver except to qualify on the range. Now, in the course of this day, I had killed once, hopefully, and planned to kill twice more. So I wait. For backup? For my friends, I hope. Surrounded by acres of dilapidated appliances closer in and derelict cars on the perimeter, I know my enemies could be hidden almost any place, ready to render me as lifeless as the discarded hardware in this junkyard. My head is on a swivel looking for signs of bad guys and my friends. Gravel crunches near the opposite side of the vehicle I'm using for protection. I pick up my second weapon, taking aim at that door with my left hand while continuing to maintain a sweeping watch in case my enemies decide to come at me from two sides. Backup should get here any minute now, I hope.
Lennox Randon reading from the prologue of his book, Friends, Dogs, Bullets, Lovers. And, of course, that scene comes back around almost at the end of the book and resolves the excitement, the action, the mystery that has been going on throughout the book. When you were working on this project with Rob and Dennis, what are some of the ways that they changed it?
Originally, I wasn't going to have a prologue. And Dennis came up with the idea of a prologue. And the dynamic of the group is that we toss out ideas. We'll say, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? And it's up to the writer themselves to decide, okay, that's a good idea. I'll use it. That's not a good idea. I won't use it. Maybe I'll use part of that idea. But Dennis's idea of a prologue said, nah, I don't think I want to use that. That's overused. And then I thought about it, and I thought about it some more. I said, you know what? That's a great idea. And that's kind of how we do things. We toss ideas out there and see what sticks. If there's a scene, for example, I had a knife fight scene once that I thought, I need to make sure this works right because I hadn't had a knife fight in over 25 years. And so I asked Rob to help me.
Most of us have never even had a knife fight.
Yeah, I haven't had any either.
So how did he help you with the knife fight?
Well, I told Rob to attack me with a knife. We used a pen instead of a real knife because, like I said, I was rusty. And we worked through it a few times. I just wanted to make sure the action was believable and real and that I remembered what I was doing because it's been so long.
I lost a fight every time. It was really discouraging, actually. I couldn't get him with the pen at all.
Well, I guess you know what to avoid
right,
in your personal life then, since you probably hadn't already thought that you wanted to avoid knife fights. Can you guys think of some of the ways that you made suggestions to Randon about his book, some of the things that would come up?
Repeated? Well, the way the prologue thing came up was when Randon first started his book, he wrote it sequentially in order, you know, everything happened in the order that it happened in real time. And one of the things that Rob and I suggested was since your narrative is pretty straightforward, it might be more interesting to the reader if you jump back and forth a little bit so that you're teasing out the different details and the backstory as you go along instead of experiencing it sequentially as it happens. And, that's some advice that I took. You know, that's the thing. You give somebody else advice and then you go, okay, I really need to work harder and do that better myself too.
Did it take a while for you guys to develop the trust? I mean, because you kind of met through this process too. You weren't particularly good friends before you started writing together, right?
Well, Dennis and I have known each other for a long, long time. And I knew Randon sort of tangentially because he was coaching this team with my wife that his daughter and my son were on. But he always says this, so I'll say it myself this time. Every time he saw me, my nose was in a book and I never talked to anybody. So
I knew his wife and son really well. We were really close. We'd been working together hours and hours on Lego leagues and robotics and so forth.
But to answer your question, you know, that's actually one of the most remarkable things to me about this group is how quickly we got into a rhythm of trusting each other, it helps that we're writing, as you've said in the setup, fairly similar books in terms of genre. And it helps that we were sort of at the same place in terms of our writing process, in terms of learning to do this. And so, writing groups, they don't always work because they get too big, because someone has an ego even bigger than my own. There are all kinds of reasons that they fall apart. So we feel very fortunate that the rhythm and the trust factor was there really right from the start.
It started very quickly because it was obvious not only that we were serious, but it was obvious that we all had areas of expertise. Rob, in addition to his work in marketing and grant writing, you know, is also a book reviewer. You know, people pay him to read books and reflect on them and critique them. That's instant credibility. The main character in my book is a police detective. Randon is an ex-cop. How many times did I come to group and say, okay, would a real policeman do this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was huge because I was writing from the point of view, not from an experience level at all. And I guess, and I, like Rob, always have my nose in a book. I've read thousands of books. So reading these books and reflecting on them was a very natural thing to do, too.
Randon, were you concerned at all that, again, they were joking about you playing the cancer card to get the group together. Were you concerned at all that they were going to treat you more gently because of your illness?
That never occurred to me because
they didn't? Or?
they didn't. And we were just so businesslike about it. When they got to my house, I didn't offer them water and hors d'oeuvres or anything like that. We just went straight to work. Every time we just went straight to work and we were very focused and we always point out each other's typos, and if there's a misspelled word, anything like that, we always point it out. And the first few times, like, oh man, I can't believe it. This is so embarrassing. But then after a while, you realize we're all doing the same things. We're all making typos. It's just the nature of the beast. And, you know, got to leave your ego at the door. Listen to what they say. If it makes sense for you, do it. If it doesn't, then don't do it. We all have the final say in our own books.
Well, you mentioned blocking out a knife fight in your basement. Were you remembering an actual knife fight that you were involved in?
It was actually – I've had knife fights before, but not one like this. This was an exercise from training when we had martial arts training in the academy and then in some other courses that I took. And I thought, okay, that would make a really good scene, one of the things we used to do in the training classes. And so – I worked that out with Rob.
All right. Yeah. And you mentioned that the friends that are the main characters in the book, they take their dogs for a midnight hike in Maquoketa Caves. Did you travel around a little bit to make sure that you had your environments right? They lived in Dubuque, then they moved to Texas.
Yeah, I used to live in Austin. I'm from Houston, but I lived in Austin for about 7 years. And I've been to Maquoketa Cave several times just to kind of scout things out and make sure it made sense. I've been to Dubuque also, just to make sure things made sense to people who had actually been to those places.
Well, and the scene that was referred to in your prologue plays out in a big way toward the end of the novel, and there is a lot of action. It's taking place in a junkyard, basically, and there are lots of different places where different people who are involved in the fight are. There are moving vehicles. How did you map all of that out?
I have a friend, the guy Lee in the novel is based on my real friend Lee, and
cleverly disguised.
Yeah. I have to refer to him as the real Lee versus the novel Lee sometimes. I went to visit him, and we drove around Austin, and there's a library that's referred to. We drove by this library. I made sure I took some photos and things, and we drove around, and there were all these junkyards. And I thought, these would make for a really good scene. So I kind of took some photos, and I thought, okay, I'm going to kind of combine several different junkyards to make one really spectacular junkyard. So I've got a bunch of photos on my computer at home now where I kind of look back at things and just make sure things make sense.
All right. The tour of the Austin, Texas junkyards must have been spectacular.
Oh, yes, I'd recommend it to anyone.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about your book now, Rob. And again, Randon was a former cop. You were a former pizza delivery guy, right?
Right. It doesn't sound nearly as glamorous, does it?
Right.
I just not nearly the kind of expertise or credibility or anything like that. But that's true. I, in late high school and throughout college, I delivered pizza for the Godfather's Pizza franchise that is sadly gone on 6th Street in Cedar Rapids. And despite all the wonderful jobs I've had since then and have right now, it's probably my favorite job ever because, you know, you pick a pizza up off the counter and you go get in your car and you're all by yourself listening to whatever you want on the radio. But it's also a job that leads to odd and interesting experiences. People who try to pay you in beer instead of in money. People who aren't home when you get there with their food. People who are home but decide they want something different than what you've brought them. Or a whole range of experiences, that some of which made it into the novel itself. And so all those years ago when I sat down to write my little mystery novel, I thought, well, Well, I was about the same age as my lead character, and I thought, well, I know how to do this. I know how to write about being a pizza delivery driver. And again, what tripped me up is that I didn't know anything about how to write a mystery novel. I could have written about pizza delivery all day long, but I don't know that anyone would want to read that over the long haul.
Well, you do have a lot of really useful tips for pizza delivery drivers in your novel.
That's true. You know, they're called the Rules for Peaceful Pizza Delivery, and those have been a few of them have been in the book from the very beginning, from way back in the day. It quickly was clear, having talked to the group from Dennis and Randon's feedback, that those were really working. But the challenge of having a device like that is that you have to continue to make it work over time. You have to keep thinking of them. And, you know, people have asked me, well, did you keep a list of these when you were actually delivering pizza? Well, no, I did not. And so those sort of developed as the writing situation required them. And of course, again, as we talked about, I'm working on a sequel now and need even more of them. So it's both a blessing and a curse, those those rules for peaceful pizza delivery, I'm afraid.
All right. Well, the novel is called Murder by the Slice. Could you read us a little bit?
I'd be happy to. We'll pick it up right from the top here. A pizza delivery driver encounters all kinds of customers, men and women, young and old, rich and poor, every ethnicity from Albanian to Zulu, vegetarian and carnivore, straight and gay, with children and without, dog, cat, fish, and bird people, single, married, cohabitating, stressed and laid back, shy and friendly, fat and thin, those who tip and those who don't. But all my customers had one simple thing in common beyond a hankering for pizza. They were all alive. And then one night, one of them wasn't. Pie to fly, a greasy pizza box landed on the delivery table with a thump. I looked over from my post at the dishwashing machine to see who was up. It was hard to keep track on a Friday night with five drivers and a steady stream of pizza to deliver. It was either me or Ed. I thought it was Ed who was over-greasing pans. Hey, Ed, you up? Don't know, man. It's either you or me. This was something of a triumph of logic for Ed, who was perhaps not the sharpest pizza cutter in the drawer. I'll check the sign-in sheet, I told him. The sign-in sheet would tell me which one of us had returned a passable pizza first after the last frenzied round of deliveries. First in, first out. That's the first rule of peaceful pizza delivery. Actually, the fact that I was washing dishes and Ed was greasing pans suggested I had been back first. Virtually no one chose greasing pans over washing dishes. The only good thing about greasing pans was that your hands were waterproof for days. I imagine God prepared to part the Red Sea by greasing a few pizza pans. Paul, you going to deliver that thing or should I refrigerate it for later? Frank Passable, honors graduate of the Management Success Through Sarcasm program, pushed through the saloon-style doors that separated the front counter area from the kitchen. Ed forgot to sign in again, boss, I said to the man who thought Passable Pizza was a Jim Dandy name for a restaurant. I'm not sure who's up. Frank glanced back at Ed, who was now inexplicably bent over the tub of grease, staring intently inside. That boy brings new meaning to grease monkey, Frank opined. Hit the road, Paul. I scooped up the delivery bag and took a look at the ticket. Too late, I realized I should have let Greasy Ed slide ahead of me in the lineup. Instead, I had to go to the Sunnyside Apartments. Despite the cheery moniker, Sunnyside Apartments was anything but sunny. In fact, I had my own nickname for the complex, one drawn straight from the comic books I avidly read. I called the Sunnyside Apartments Gotham City.
Rob Klein reading from his novel Murder by the Slice. And give us a little bit of a plot synopsis. I mean, we're all expecting something bad to happen next, and something bad does happen.
Something
next.
Bad does happen. He goes to Gotham City, where he finds his putative customer dead, and the cops arrive on the scene, and mayhem ensues. And he finds himself possibly a suspect. He's not quite sure because the cops are nowhere near as good at their jobs as Randon was when he was a cop. He finds himself the subject of interest of a lovely collegiate reporter who plays a little bit fast and loose with her journalistic ethics and chases Paul quite a bit. And he finds himself the target of the bad guys who want to know what he knows. And so he, despite his desire to sort of stay home and pet his rabbit and read his comic books, he finds himself having to take action to untangle all of that.
So now we already talked about how Noah in Randon's book is his alter ego. Is Paul your alter ego?
Well,
Bob?
Paul certainly talks in my voice. And of course, because he has some of my experiences, he is similar to me in that way as well. I would like to think that I wasn't quite as cloistered. Well, by the time I was writing this book, I was married and I had a child. So I wasn't quite as cloistered as Paul Chambers is. But certainly people who know me, who read the book, tell me that they hear it in my voice. And I think that's totally appropriate.
And you mentioned earlier when you were talking about the kind of interaction that you guys had, you know, people saying, hey, your character wouldn't really say that. I got the impression from reading a newspaper article that that's something you heard more than the others. Is that accurate?
In a couple of contexts, Dennis was talking about our various skills. One of Dennis's great gifts that he brings to the group is that he has a real ear for the way people talk to one another and quickly picks up how individual characters talk over time. And so he's very good at helping us sort that out. He's also very good, with an assist from Randon, at making sure the words that I use are not too big. Now, I would argue that none of the words I use are too big. And I would also argue that because Paul is overeducated and undermotivated, it's part of his character to use these so-called large words. But we do try to follow what I call the Dennis Green rule, which is this, Rob. If I don't know a word, it does not belong in your book. So every word in Murder by the Slice is known by Dennis Green.
Vetted personally by me.
All right. We're going to take a short break, then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about three novels that came out of a writing group in Cedar Rapids with Rob Klein, Lennox Randon, and Dennis Green. And the three of them will be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City coming up Wednesday night at 7 o'clock. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me today are three members of a writing group in Cedar Rapids. They've been writing together for a little bit over 2 years. They have a 100% completion rate for their projects and a 100% publication rate, which is incredibly unusual. With me today, Lennox Randon, Rob Klein, and Dennis Green. And Rob, before the break, we were talking about your book, Murder by the Slice, and you're working on a sequel to it now?
I am. It's called It's All About the Dough, and it's a counterfeiting story. It has a problem similar to the early days of Murder by the Slice. It has no plot. It does, however, have 45,000 words of plot-free goodness. So that's where we are right now.
That's going to look great on the jacket.
It is.
Well, Dennis, let's talk a little bit about your book. And, of course, Rob and Randon, their books just came out. But you're getting a little early publicity because your book doesn't come out until October, right?
Right. My book was picked up by a small publishing company, great publishing company called Embedzy Publishing. And it's in the hopper and is coming out in October.
All right. It's called Traveler, and it, too, is a mystery, but it's a very different kind of mystery. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, they always say write what you know. And, of course, as you mentioned, I'm employed in broadcasting and do a few other things on the side. So you might think that I would write a book about broadcasting or maybe the music industry or theater or entertainment or something like that.
But you did not.
Totally did not. Completely and absolutely. I wrote a sci-fi novel about parallel realities and a particularly outlandish theory that combines particle physics, mythology, and Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And all I can really say to justify that is that the thing that people don't know about me is that I'm a lifelong sci-fi geek and have read tens of thousands of sci-fi and mystery novels. And when I sat down, I wrote a book that I thought I'd like to read.
Was this a project that you had started on and put away, or was this something you started because of this group?
It was an idea. When Rob and Randon invited me to join the group, I sifted through the little idea pile of stuff. And I have been writing over the years. I actually wrote a young adult mystery novel about 20 years ago. I've had a couple of short stories published and just had a few ideas in the hopper. And this is the one that came up. As I said, it's a story of parallel realities. And it uses as its jumping off point the idea that we've all experienced where you're looking for something, maybe your car keys, and you look everywhere for them. And you finally found them in a place where you could have sworn you already looked. You know, they were in your jacket pocket. I looked in my jacket pocket. How'd they get there? Well, the answer to this in my world is because every day all of us shift slightly from different streams of reality. and we don't notice because the differences are so small. The differences are small enough that in one reality, your car keys were in your pocket, and in the other reality, they rolled under the couch. And that's why we have that feeling every day. And our brains smooth over these little discontinuities every day because, of course, you know, my keys must have been there all the time. Where else could they have been? They couldn't have been in a parallel universe. That's ridiculous. And my main character is a police detective named Trav Becker, who is at the absolute lowest possible point in his life that anyone could be. His partner was killed in a call they responded to that kind of ended up being Trav's fault, or at least he blames himself for it. He's been suspended, and he is anticipating that he'll be fired when he goes into work on the day the story begins. In the process, he's lost his girlfriend, who he loves very much, because of his inability to get over this whole situation. And after a particularly despondent night of drunkenness, he's awakened by his friend Sam, who is a scientist, who arrives to pick him up and tell him, in essence, you know, you got to, you know, don't sit around here. You got to make him go in and fire you to your face. So he gets up. He kind of tries to pull himself together. And as they drive to work, a couple of odd things happen. But, of course, he's more hungover than anything else, and he doesn't put too much stock in that. But it becomes obvious as the, you know, as the book starts to build that, you know, something weird is going on here.
So you did you had Randon to tell you about the cop work to say, you know, does this seem real? Does this seem not real? How did you go about trying to make the science part of this believable?
Well, a lot of it was just things that I had read a lot over the years. There, incidentally, and I don't know this guy, I can't plug him, but there is a fellow who on the internet will offer to put you in touch with parallel reality versions of yourself to give you career and life advice.
Interesting. Or to help you find your keys, perhaps.
Right. Which I found out much later. I kind of bookmarked it. I thought, well, you know, it worked for Ron Hubbard.
That's right.
To create a religion out of whole cloth.
Worked very, very well indeed. And when it comes to the science fiction aspect of this, I should plug my important role in each week's meeting, which was to say, what now?
And you know, and it was challenging because I was, you know, yeah, I was juggling. You know, I think that my book has, you know, 25 different characters, 20 of whom are all different versions of the same two people. So we talked a lot about how to, you know, how to differentiate the voices of two people who were, in essence, the same person. And, you know, that was one of the things that we talked with a lot. And, you know, none of us really write from outlines. And again, you know, when I came into this, it was with really, you know, I hadn't really done any pre-work. I just started writing, and I would leave the meeting every week and say, I'm pretty sure it's going to completely fall apart under its own weight this week. I think that next week I will come and say I have had to give up. But every week I was able to bring a few more pages that made some sort of sense.
That must have been really difficult to keep track of all of the different changes as readers reading about four pages at a time. Was that a challenge, Randon?
Definitely. When you read a book, normally it takes you a week or two to read it. But it's taken us a year to get through each other's books, and so we're trying to keep track of all the different characters, and in Dennis's case, all the different versions of one character. So we always had to get, Dennis, now is this the one that did this, or is that the one that did that? And it got a little confusing, but it worked.
Tell me again, which branch is the home branch? Where does Trav actually live? Which girlfriend? It was confusing. My role was to be the dumb guy in the room so that Dennis would know how to appeal to the lowest common denominator of sci-fi readers who need the most guideposts to get through the novel.
But there, another important part of our group was we all had to know when to let go, because there came a point in each of our books where we realized we couldn't give each other any more feedback, that it really needed now to go to another set of beta readers who could read it from a blank start and give us feedback on the entire project rather than the incremental way that we had been doing it up
sure.
to now.
Sure. Well, and I'm sure that not only did you have to keep track of all of these different changes and iterations of the same character, but also the changes that Dennis had made based on the feedback mm-hmm. that you guys had given him.
Well, there were many days I would come in with a completely new subplot, and show it to him and I say, don't worry, I'll set this up 50 pages back. I promise.
Wow. Can you read us just a little bit?
Sure. This takes place in the beginning of the book. And as I said, you know, Trav wakes up. He's hungover. He's pretty much lost everything. His apartment's a mess. His car's a mess.
And if I recall correctly, you may have to do a little editing for broadcast.
Possibly.
Okay.
he and Sam head to work, and he heads up to his office for what he anticipates will be the last time. Passed by my own desk, empty of course, it faced the equally empty desk that had been Adam's, whose personal items were still scattered across the desktop. Apparently after he died, no one had thought to box them up for his parents. Captain's office was at the far end of the room. A couple of detectives called out a cheerful greeting to me as I passed. I waved back, but was a little puzzled. Everyone knew I was under suspension and about to be terminated, but people were nodding and greeting me just like it was a normal beginning of shift. No quick glances, both at and away from me. None of the nervous chatter you try to exchange with a cop who you knew was going down. No trying to act normal while at the same time hoping that unlucky cop mojo wouldn't rub off on you. Two chairs sat outside the captain's closed door. I stopped by the desk nearest the office, occupied by a detective named Anderson. He in? Anderson sighed, acting as Captain Martin's unofficial receptionist, pained to no end. Yeah, he's waiting for you. I shut the door behind me and took the lone chair in front of the captain's desk. Leon Martin was in his early 50s, but looked 10 years younger. His gray hair was cropped astronaut close. He wore black chinos, a royal blue Oxford shirt with the sleeves rolled just past the wrist, and yellow tie loosened at the neck. Trav, I don't really know where to start. He paused and looked down at his cluttered desk. Look, Leon, it's all right. Let's just get it over with. Good idea. Detective Becker, as a result of the events of 19 August and the subsequent investigation, it is the opinion of the review board. Here it comes. It was funny. I thought I was prepared for this moment, but now that it was actually here, I didn't know what to do. I fought to keep a neutral expression on my face. I couldn't look at Martin, so I studied a spot on his desk, which almost caused me to miss what he actually was saying. That your quick thinking and bravery during the shooting prevented loss of life and certainly saved that of your partner. So it's my pleasure to tell you that in a unanimous decision, the board is recommending you to receive the award for valor in the performance of duty. There'll be a presentation ceremony next month. Congratulations, Trav. What the hell? I don't understand. Now I did look up at the captain, searching his face for some explanation. Is this some kind of a joke? I'll say, came a voice behind me. I get shot, you get a medal. Still trying to make sense of this insane turn of events, I hadn't heard the door open behind me. Now I turned and saw half the squad crowded into the doorway, huge grins on their faces. They gathered behind the young man who had just spoken. Right arm in a sling, crooked grin on his face, and not looking at all dead, Adam Yount leaned against the door jamb.
And that's when he discovers that he's
entered
a parallel.
He has traveled.
Universe. All right. That's Dennis Green reading from his forthcoming novel, Traveler. And you're working on a sequel as well?
Yes. Obviously, things work out for Trav, although he ends up not quite where he started off in this tale. And in the second book, he once again gets involved in a local crime that he is investigating, while at the same time trying to hide a dead body in his apartment, which is himself.
Uh-huh.
Listen to that. Dennis has a plot. Isn't that impressive?
And Randon, you're not working on a sequel, but you are working on another novel.
Something completely different. It's a historical fiction novel that takes place in the years 1858, 1859. It was inspired by, I went to an art exhibit of Jacob Lawrence paintings with my wife a long time ago. And I saw these paintings, and they were telling the story of Harriet Tubman. And I found out that Harriet Tubman passed out. She'd been beaten so badly once that she passed out just every now and then for hours at a time. And I thought, wow, what a brave person. She's going back here rescuing people despite knowing that she could at any point pass out. I should write a book about that. And in my novel, I have a character come from about the year 2000, and she travels back in time to that time into the body of a person in that time period, and they meet Harriet Tubman and John Brown, and wacky adventures ensue.
We started this conversation talking about your cancer diagnosis. How is your health now?
What's happening basically is I'm slowing down. I'm losing stamina right now. I think the chemotherapy is basically just acting on my body at a cellular level, and my muscles and things are breaking down. But I don't think people can really tell that there's anything wrong with me, but I feel it. I can't walk but a few blocks at a time, and I used to be able to just go on 5-mile hikes at any time and things like that. So I'm definitely weakening, but the chemo is keeping me alive, and I'm just becoming accustomed to a more sedentary lifestyle.
What are some of the other things what are some of your other goals right now in addition to finishing this historical novel?
I would like to just get my daughter rolling and feel like she's on a good path and make sure my wife's comfortable with everything. I think we've had time now to get used to things. And beyond getting the novel done, I'd really like to break 200 in bowling once more. So I'm going to get Rob's son to help me with that.
Nice. Nice. How do you think you've changed through this writing process?
Wow. I'd have to say that I'm just more comfortable with myself and my mortality. I'm used to it now, and I've accepted it, and I'm hopeful, but I'm not optimistic. I'm very realistic about the whole thing. I know what's going to happen somewhere down the line, and I'm just hoping I can put it off as long as possible. But well, I feel like it's made me a better husband and a better father, which is pretty cool, I think.
Well, I hope you'll come back and talk to us about your next novel, too.
Thanks.
And we have just a moment left. Rob, how do you think this process has changed you?
Well, Dennis and I always say, and we believe this wholeheartedly, that Randon, in addition to helping us meet goals of our own, he's an object lesson, a living, breathing object lesson in dignity and grace under stressful circumstances. I could not ask for a more inspiring example. And so it's been just an honor to have even a little to do with the writing of his book, let alone to finish ours as well.
Dennis?
We go, every Sunday, and we've said, we do the work, we focus on the writing, but Rob and I are learning lessons about life and how to live it that go far beyond writing novels.
Well, thank you all for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
This hour I've been talking to Lennox Randon, who is the author of Friends, Dogs, Bullets, Lovers, Rob Klein, author of Murder by the Slice, and Dennis Green, whose book Traveler will be coming out this fall. The three of them will be reading together at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City on Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Ben Kiefer is here with me now to give us a preview of River to River today at noon. What's coming up on the show, Ben?
Hi, Charity. It's all about memories today. In the first half hour, we're going to be talking about some new research with an Iowa State University psychologist talking about how memories, existing memories that you or I have, Charity, could be manipulated, could be changed after the fact. It's kind of interesting. There's been a few movies about that. Perhaps you've seen those. Then in the second half hour, we're going to talk about how memories are dealt with in our aging communities, in assisted care living, for instance, how we can tap into memories that are perhaps 60, 70 years old, and there'll be some interesting tools that we'll be given some ways to do that. So
also be talking a little bit about how to keep our brains strong and supple so we retain those memories?
I'm sure a little bit of that will be in there, too. Also an author, Christine Sutton, author of a book called Stop and Smell the Garbage, A Caregiver's Story of Survival, will be on our show today. So thank you, Charity.
Ben Kiefer, host of River to River today at noon. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa, a production of Iowa Public Radio News.